Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. And tonight we're going to... thought I might do another tarot reading for anybody who would like to call in tonight. Be happy to do a tarot for a reading for you. Let's see. I have a lot to consider tonight. I was going to do a piece on fairy tales and rather the uses of enchantment and how fairy tales are remarkable devices of communication, how they not only inspire children, but continue to inspire adults. And reminds me, the same as parables, how prophets have used parables over time. Mystics have solved riddles and so on. And these are essentially the elements that we survive with mentally. And those concepts never leave us for some reason. Everybody remembers their favorite fairy tale. There's something I wanted to read this segment as part of the introduction. Actually, it's the first chapter of this book, which is called "The Uses of Enchantment" by Bruno Bethlehem, and the meanings and importance of fairy tales. And it was put out by Vintage Books, a division of Random House. The copyright is 1989. Vintage Book Edition. Original copy was 1975. I'm just going to start with chapter one because I thought that was rather interesting. Little Red Riding Hood was my first love, he says. I felt that if I could have married Little Red Riding Hood, I should have known perfect bliss. And the statement by Charles Dickens indicates that he, like untold millions of children all over the world throughout the ages, was enchanted by fairy tales. Even when world-famous Dickens acknowledged the deep formative impact that the wondrous figures and events of fairy tales had had on him and his creative genius, he repeatedly expressed scorn for those who, motivated by an uninformed and petty rationality, insisting on rationalizing, bowdlerizing, or outlawing these stories, and thus rob children of the important contributions fairy tales could make to their lives. Dickens understood that the imagery of fairy tales helps children better than anything else in their most difficult and yet most important and satisfying task, achieving a more mature consciousness to civilize the chaotic pressures of their unconscious. Today, as in the past, the minds of both creative and average children can be open to an appreciation of all the higher things in life by fairy tales, from which they can move easily to enjoy the greatest works of literature and art. The poet, Louis MacNeice, for example, tells the real fairy stories always meant much to me as a person. Even when I was at a public school, there were, to admit this meaning, losing face. Contrary to what many people say, even now a fairy story, at least of the classical folk variety, is a much more solid affair than the average naturalistic novel, whose books go much deeper than a gossip column. From folk tales and sophisticated fairy tales, such as Hans Andersen's or Norse mythology, and stories like the Alice books and Water Babies, I graduated at about the age of 12 to the Fairy Queen. And literary critics such as J.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis felt the fairy stories are spiritual explorations, and hence the most lifelike, since they reveal human life as seen or felt or divined from the inside. Fairy tales, unlike any other form of literature, direct the child to discover his identity and calling, and they also suggest that experiences are needed to develop his character fuller, further. Fairy tales initiate, fairy tales intimate with fairy tales intimate that a rewarding good life is within one's reach despite adversity, but only if one does not shy away from the hazardous struggles without which one can never achieve true identity. These stories promise that if a child dares to engage in his fearsome and taxing search, benevolent powers will come to his aid and he will succeed. The story is so worn that those who are too timorous and narrow-minded to risk themselves in finding themselves must settle down to a humdrum existence if an even worse fate does not befall them. Past generations of children who loved and felt the importance of fairy tales were subjected to the scorn only of, pedants, and happened to McNeese. Today, many of our children are far more grievously bereaved because they are deprived of a chance to know fairy stories at all. Most children now meet fairy tales only in purified and simplified versions, which subdued their meaning and robbed them of all deeper significance versions such as those on film and TV shows, where fairy tales are turned into empty-minded entertainment. Through most of man's history, a child's intellectual life, apart from immediate experiences within the family, depend on mythical and religious stories and on fairy tales. The traditional literature fed the child's imagination and stimulated his fantasizing. Simultaneously, since these stories answered the child's most important questions, they were a major agent of his socialization. Myths and closely related religious legends offered material from which children formed their concepts of the world's origins and purpose, and of the social ideals a child could pattern himself after. These were the images of the conquered hero Achilles and wily Odysseus of Hercules, whose life history showed that it is not beneath the dignity of the strongest man to clean the filthiest stable, of St. Martin, who cut his coat in half to clothe a poor beggar. It's not just since Freud that the myth of Oedipus has become the image by which we understand the ever new but age old problems posed to us by our complex and ambivalent feelings about our parents. And Freud referred to this ancient story to make us aware of the inescapable cauldron of emotions which every child in his own way has to manage at a certain age. In Hindu civilization, the story of Rama and Sita, part of the Ramayana, which tells of their peaceable courage and their passionate devotion to each other, is the prototype of love and marriage relationships. The culture, moreover, enjoins everyone to try to relive this myth in his or her own life. Every Hindu bride is called Sita, and as part of her wedding ceremony, she acts out certain episodes of the myth. And I'm reading Those of you who may have joined me, might just have joined me, the reading The Uses of Enchantment, The Meaning and Importance of Fairy Tales by Bruno Bettelheim. And it's kind of a good book. It talks about many different fairy tales, how they work on our psyche and how they can encourage us and as children to think large, think bigger, and think in terms of heroes and in terms of mind over matter. Magical stories about lost children and things like that, and dangers and joys of childhood and fantasy. That period of time when you believe everything that you hear, that you heard, you know, you can't quite distinguish between the truth and fallacy. And maybe there is no difference, really. Yeah, you're living what you're seeing, what you're imagining. As your worst fears become your reality, and because you're drawing them to you. Whereas a good fairy tale can makes you think in different levels of your subconscious and conscious mind, and you become more more appreciative of the written word, and also the power of illustration. So many of the wonderful fairy tales were illustrated by remarkable artists. So you remember these things, and you remember their effect on you, and they affect you very strongly. Fairy tales, unlike any other form of literature, direct the child to discover his identity and calling. And they also suggest what experiences are needed to develop that character further. I know I read this, but I wanted to repeat it. Fairy tales intimate that a rewarding good life is within one's reach, despite adversity, but only if one does not shy away from the hazardous struggles, which one can never achieve true identity. These stories promise that if a child dares to engage this fearsome and taxing search, benevolent powers will come to his aid, and he will succeed. And the stories also warn that those who are too timorous and narrow-minded to risk themselves in finding themselves must settle down to a humdrum existence, if an even worse a fate does not befall them. And I repeated that only because I felt that was an extremely important lesson that they learned, that you learn through fairy tales. And past generations of children who loved and felt the importance of fairy tales were subjected to the scorn only of pedants, and happened to McNeese. Today, many of our children are fed more grievously bereaved because they are deprived of the chance to know fairy stories at all. Most children now meet fairy tales only in fortified and simplified versions. Through most of man's history, a child's intellectual life, apart from immediate experiences within the family, depended on mythical and religious stories and on fairy tales. The traditional literature fed the child's imagination and stimulated his fantasizing. Simultaneously, since these stories answered the child's most important questions, they were a major agent of his socialization. Myths and closely related religious legends offered material from which children formed their concepts of the world's origin and purpose, and of the social ideals a child could pattern himself after. These were the images of the unconscious heroes Achilles and Odysseus and Hercules, whose life history showed that it is not beneath the dignity of the strongest man to clean the filthiest stable. And there's the and I mentioned this. In a fairy tale, internal processes are externalized and become comprehensible as represented by the figures of the stories in its event. This is the reason why, in traditional Hindu medicine, a fairy tale giving form to this his particular problem was offered to a psychically disoriented person for his meditation. It was expected that through contemplating the story, the disturbed person would be led to visualize both the nature of the impasse in living from which he suffered and the possibility of its resolution. From what a particular tale implied about man's despair, hopes, methods of overcoming tribulations, the patient could discover not only a way out of his distress, but also a way to find himself, and the hero of the story did, as the hero of the story did. And, you know, you're using most of mankind's diseases are brought upon by his own psychological, you know, makeup, where he is at that time depends. Like if they're depressed, if they're thinking about things that they're, you know, things aren't, you know, if you're in a depressive mood, it weakens your immune system and therefore you attract different diseases, colds, flus, you know, the viruses. But if you're in a positive mood, or if you have a positive path to follow, like, you know, in the fairy tale, you know, you, like, for instance, let's take a general fairy tale, you know, the story of the three pigs. The story of the three pigs was that, you know, one built his house by sticks and one by straw and another with bricks. And, and of course everybody knows that the, you know, the big bad wolf came along and huffed and puffed and blew down the straw house, blew down the stick house, but could not blow down the brick house. And that's and that story generates an entire it has its own legacy. It in its own deep rooted message, you know, to a child and to an adult, that, you know, build your foundation with brick and build it strong and build it, speak so that, you know, build your home with brick and stone so it won't fall in the winds, you know, and nature can't destroy it as quickly as it can, you know, another house. It'll be a lot safer. So don't be silly and build a card, you know, and don't build a house of cards, you know, or a house of straw, or a house of sticks. Make sure that everything you do is, you know, centered around a solid foundation, solid commitments, and solid relationships. And these are the lessons learned by the deeper meanings learned by these lighthearted fairy tales. And let's see, where am I here? As the paramount importance of fairy tales for the growing individual resides in something other than teaching about correct ways of behaving in this world, such wisdom is plentifully supplied in religion, myths, and fables. Fairy stories do not pretend to describe the world as it is, nor do they advise that one ought to do. If they did, the Hindu patient would be induced to follow an imposed pattern of behavior, which is not just bad therapy, but the opposite of therapy. The fairy tale is therapeutic because the patient finds his own solutions through contemplating what the story seems to imply about him and his inner conflicts at his moment in his time, in his life. The content of Chosen Tale usually has nothing to do with the patient's external life, but much to do with his inner problems, which seem incomprehensible and hence unsolvable. The fairy tale clearly does not refer to the outer world, although it may begin realistically enough and have everything, or rather everyday features woven into it. The unrealistic nature of these tales, which narrow-minded rationalists object to, is an important device because it makes obvious that the fairy tales concerning its concern is not useful information about the external world, but the inner processes take place in an individual. In most cultures, there is no clear line separating myth from folk tale. All these together form the literature of pre-literate societies. The Nordic languages have only one word for both, which is saga. German has retained the word sage for myths, while fairy stories are called Märchen. Let's see. It is unfortunate that both the English and French names for these stories emphasize the role of fairies in them, because in most, no fairies appear. Myths and fairy tales alike attain a definite form only when they are committing to writing and are no longer subject to continuous change. Before being written down, these stories were either condensed or vastly elaborated in the retelling over the centuries. Some stories merged with others. All became modified by the teller, by what the teller thought was of greatest interest to his listeners, by what his concerns of the moment or the special problems of his era were. Some fairy and folk stories evolved out of myths. Others were incorporated into them. Both forms embodied the cumulative experience of a society as men wished to recall past wisdom for themselves and transmit it to future generations. These tales are the purveyors of deep insights that have sustained mankind through the long vicissitudes of its existence, a heritage that is not revealed in any other form as simply and directly or as accessibly to children. Myths and fairy tales have much in common, but in myths, much more than in fairy stories, the culture hero is presented to the listener as a figure he ought to emulate in his own life as far as possible. It's kind of like Superman, you know? We grew up with those great figures. The myth, like a fairy tale, may express an inner conflict in symbolic form and suggest how it may be solved. But this is not necessarily the myth's central concern. The myth presents its theme as a majestic way. It carries spiritual force, and the divine is present and is experienced in the form of superhuman heroes who make constant demands on mere mortals. Much as we, the mortals, may strive to be like these heroes, we will remain always and obviously inferior to them. The figures and events of fairy tales also personify and illustrate inner conflicts, but they suggest ever so subtly how these conflicts may be solved and what the next step in the development toward a higher humanity might be. The fairy tale is presented in a simple, homely way. No demands are made on the listener. This prevents even the smallest child from feeling compelled to act in specific ways, and he is never made to feel inferior. Far from making demands, the fairy tale reassures, gives hope for the future, and holds on to the promises of a happy ending. That is why Lewis Carroll called it a love gift, a term hardly applicable to a myth. Obviously, not even a story Not every story contained in a collection called Fairy Tales meets these criteria. Many of these stories are simply diversions, cautionary tales, or fables. If they are fables, they tell by means of words, actions, and events, fabulous though these may be, what one ought to do. Fables demand and threaten. They are moralistic, or they just entertain. To decide whether a story is a fairy tale or something entirely different, one might ask whether it could rightly be called a love gift to a child. This is not a bad way to arrive at a classification. To understand how a child views fairy tales, let us understand as examples the many fairy stories in which a child outwits a giant who scares him or even threatens his life. The children intuitively understand that these giants stand for is illustrated by the spontaneous reaction of a five-year-old. Encouraged by discussion about the importance fairy tales have for children, mother overcame her hesitation about telling such gory and threatening stories to her son. From her conversation with him, she knew that her son already had fantasies about eating people or people getting eaten. So she told the tale of Jack the Giant Killer. His response at the end of the story was, "There aren't any such things as giants, are there?" And before the mother could give her son the reassuring reply, which was on her tongue, and which would have destroyed the value of the story for him, he continued, "But there are such things as grown-ups, and they're like giants." At the ripe old age of five, he understood the encouraging message of the story. Although adults can be experienced as frightening giants, a little boy with cunning can get the better of them. And this remark reveals one source of adult reluctance to tell fairy stories. We are not comfortable with the thought that occasionally we look like threatening giants to our children, although we do. Nor do we want to accept how easy they think it is to fool us, or to make fools of us, and how delighted they are by this idea. But whether or not we tell fairy tales to them, we do, as the example of this little boy proves, appear to them as selfish giants, we wish to keep to ourselves all the wonderful things which give us power. And fairy stories provide reassurance to children that they eventually get the better of the giant. They can grow up to be the giant and acquire the same powers. These are the mighty hopes that make us men. And most significantly, if we parents tell such fairy stories to our children, we can give them the most important reassurance of all. We approve of their playing with the idea of getting the better of these giants. Here, reading is not the same as being told a story, because while reading alone, the child may think that only some stranger, the person who wrote the story or arranged the book, approves of outwitting and cutting down the giant. But when his parents tell him the story, a child can be sure that they approve of his retaliating in fantasy for the threat which adult dominance entails. The next chapter is kind of interesting. I noticed nobody is called, so that's kind of good. That's okay. I'm getting interested in this book, so we will. I have to go back here for 1 second, though. I have to change my. I wanted to just update. Or edit my show tonight with this particular book. And hang on 1 second. I'm still willing, if anybody really does want one, I'm still willing to do the tarot reading, but I just wanted to put up this book. fairy tales and their mystical revelations. So, essentially, what I just wrote here is, I'll be updating quickly here. Tonight, for those of you who may have just joined us, I'm discussing the book The Uses of Enchantment by Bruno Bettelheim and Fairy Tales and Their Mythical Revelations to Children and Adults. I was greatly inspired by fairy tales as a child. I'm sure many people were as well, but I can't think of my most favorite. I don't remember actually which one got me, which one inspired me most. For the longest time, legends or myths had always inspired me. For instance, King Arthur's realm, of course, you know, the knights and chivalry, legends of chivalry and so on, and wizards and warlocks and all these other story-fascinating tales. But also the great tales of the Iliad and the Odyssey. Oh, man, that book, those books, rather, just, they captivated me. As a child, I was probably, I don't know, 10 when I read those books, 10, 11 years old, 13, 12. Remarkable, absolutely remarkable impression they made upon me. And of course, movies that were made, and, you know, I loved the movies about, the mythology, and, ancient wars and all this kind of stuff always fascinated me as a kid, and as well as did the. I was read to quite a bit as a child, I recall, and you know my. We were given a very, I'm going to say a very rather traditional upbringing. Father was a college graduate, and my mother was well-read. She was a high school graduate, but a very well-read woman. And they had certain expectations of their kids who would go on to college and be literate people. Hopefully, stay out of trouble and, be productive in their life. We all did. And that's a testament to her, to my parents' struggles or commitments to traditional middle class values, but also to the a commitment to higher ideals, not discouraging mystical thoughts, if you will, or not discouraging magical thoughts, but more so just keeping us on track and guiding us in a proper direction so that we could achieve our goals. Eventually stumble across through influences and writers and painters and musicians and so on, establish a path way to learning and knowledge and appreciation of life. And that's what, and those early days gave that to me, those early influences and early stories and early fantasies helped create my life. And gave it fun, gave it promise, gave it encouragement. The next piece I'm going to read is called The Fisherman and the Genie. Fairy tale compared to fable. That's how to discern what a fairy tale is and what a fable is, but essentially also what they teach and how they each has their own profound message and gift to people and to children. One of the Arabian Nights tales, The Fisherman and the Genie, gives an almost complete rendering of the fairy tale motif, which features a giant in conflict with an ordinary person. This theme is common to all cultures in some form, since children everywhere fear and chafe under the power adults hold over them. In the West, the theme is best known in the form exemplified by the Brothers Grimm stories of the Spirit in the Bottle. Children know that, short of doing adults' bidding, they have only one way to be safe from adult wrath, through outwitting them. And the Fisherman and the Genie tell how a poor fisherman casts his net into the sea four times. First he catches a dead jackass, the second time a pitcher full of sand and mud. The third effort gains him less than the preceding ones, post-herds and broken glasses. Potsherds, and broken glass. The fourth time around, the fisherman brings up a copper jar. As he opens it, a huge cloud emerges, which materializes into a giant genie, that threatens to kill him, despite all the fisherman's entreaties. The fisherman saves himself in his wits. He taunts the genie by doubting aloud the huge genie could ever have fit into such a small vessel. Thus he induces the genie to return into the jar to prove it. Then the fisherman quickly caps and seals the jar and throws it back into the ocean. In other cultures, the same motif may appear in a version where the evil figure materializes as a big, ferocious animal, which threatens to devour the hero, who, excepting for his cunning, is in no way to match for his adversity, for this adversary, rather. The hero then reflects aloud that it must be easy for each, or rather for such a powerful spirit, to take the form of a huge creature, but it could not possibly turn itself into a little animal, such as a mouse or a bird. This appeal to the vanity of the spirit spells its doom. To show that nothing is impossible to it, the evil spirit transforms itself into a tiny animal, which is then easily vanquished by the hero. In the story of the fisherman and the genie, richer in hidden messages than other versions of this fairy tale motif, as it contains significant details not always found in other renderings. One feature is that is an account of how the genie came to be so ruthless as a wish to kill the person who set him free. Another feature is that three unsuccessful attempts are finally rewarded on the fourth try. According to adult morality, the longer an imprisonment lasts, the more grateful the prisoner should be to the person who liberates him. But this is not how the genie described it. And as he sat confined in the bottle during the first 100 years, he said, "In my heart, whoso shall release me, him I will enrich forever and ever." But the full century went by, and when no one set me free, I entered upon a second 50 saying, "Whosoever shall release me from him, I shall open the hordes of the earth." Still, not one set me free, and thus 400 years passed away. Then I quoth, "Whoso shall release me from him, will I fulfill 3 wishes." Yet no one set me free. Thereupon I waxed wroth with exceeding wrath and said to myself, whoso shall release me from this time forth, him I will slay. This is exactly how a young child feels when he has been deserted. First, he thinks to himself how happy he will be when his mother comes back, or when sent to his room, how glad he will be when he is permitted to leave it again, and how he has rewarded, how he will reward mother. But as time passes, the child becomes angrier and angrier, and he fantasizes the terrible revenge he will take on those who have deprived him. In fact, that in reality, he may be very happy when reprieved does not change how his thoughts move from rewarding to punishing those who have inflicted discomfort on him. Thus, the way the genie's thought evolves gives the story psychological truth for a child. An example of this progression of feelings as shown by a 3-year-old boy whose parents had gone abroad for several weeks. The boy had been speaking quite well before his parents' departure, and continued to do so with the woman taking care of him and with others. But on his parents' return, he wouldn't say a word to them or anybody else for 2 weeks. From what he had told his caretaker, it was clear that during the first few days of his parents' absence, he had looked forward with great anticipation to their return. By the end of the first week, however, he began to talk about how angry he was that they had left him, and how he would get even with them on their return. A week later, he refused even to speak about his parents and became violently angry at anyone who mentioned them. When his mother and father did finally arrive, he silently turned away from them. Despite all efforts to reach him, the boy remained frozen in his rejection. It took several weeks of compassionate understanding of his predicament on the part of his parents before the boy could become his old self again. It seemed clear that as time passed, the child's anger had increased until it became so violent and overwhelming as to make him fear that if he let himself go, he would destroy his parents or be destroyed by in retaliation. His refusal to talk was his defense, his way of protecting both himself and his parents against the consequences of his towering rage. There was no way to know whether in the original language of the fisherman and the genie there is a saying similar to ours about bottle up feelings, but the image of confinement in a bottle was as apt then as it is now. In some forms, every child has experienced similar to those of the 3-year-old boy, though usually in less extreme form and without overt reaction like his. On his own, the child does not know what has happened to him. All he knows is that he has to act this way. Efforts to help such a child understand rationally will not affect the child and will leave him defeated to boot, since he does not yet think rationally. If you tell a small child that a little boy became so angry at his parents that he didn't talk to them for 2 weeks, his reaction will be, "That's stupid." If you try to explain why the boy didn't speak for 2 weeks, your listening child feels even more than to act this way is stupid. Now, not only because he considers the action foolish, but also because the explanation does not make sense to him. A child cannot consciously accept that his anger may make him speechless, or that he may wish to destroy those on whom he depends for his existence. To understand this would mean he must accept the fact that his own emotions may so overpower him that he does not have control over them. A very scary thought. The idea that forces may reside within us, which is beyond our control, is too threatening to be entertained and not just a child. Action takes the place of understanding for a child, and this becomes increasingly true the more strongly he feels. A child may have learned to say otherwise under adult guidance, but as he really sees it, people do not cry because they are sad. They just cry. And people do not hit out and destroy or stop talking because they're angry. They just do these things. A child may have learned that he placate adults by explaining his action thus. I did it because I'm angry. But that does not change the fact that the child does not experience anger as anger, but only as an impulse to hit, to destroy, to keep silent. Not before puberty do we begin to recognize our emotions for what they are, without immediately acting on them or wishing to do so. The child's unconscious processes can become clarified to him only through images which speak directly to his unconscious. The images evoked by fairy tales do this. As the child does not think, when mother comes back, I'll be happy, but I'll give her something. So that Jenny said to himself, whoever will release me, I'll enrich. As the child does not think, I'm so angry I could kill this person, but then I see him, I'll kill him. So that Jenny says, I'll slay whoever releases me. If a real person is said to think or act this way, that idea arouses too much anxiety to permit understanding. But the child knows that the genie is an imaginary figure, so he can afford to recognize what motivates the genie without being forced to make a direct application to himself. As the child spins fantasies around the story, and unless he does, the fairy tale loses most of its impact. He slowly becomes familiar with how the djinn responds to frustration and incarceration, an important step toward becoming acquainted with parallel reactions in himself. Such it is a fairy tale out of Never Never Land, which presents the child with these images of behaving. He can swing back and forth in his own mind between it's true, that's how one acts and reacts, and it's all untrue. It's just a story. Depending on how ready he is to recognize these processes in himself. Most important of all, since the fairy tale guarantees a happy outcome, the child need not fear, permitting this unconsciousness to come to the fore in line with story content, because he knows that whatever he may find out, he'll live happily ever after. And the fantastic exaggerations of the story, such as being bottled up for centuries, makes reactions plausible and acceptable where situations presently more realistic, such as parents' absence, would not. To the child, the parent's absence seems an eternity, a feeling that remains unaffected by mother's truthful explanation that she was gone for only half an hour. So the fairy tale's fantastic exaggeration gives it the ring of psychological truth, while realistic explanation seems psychologically untrue, however true to fact. The fisherman and the genie illustrate why the simplified and Baudelaire's fantasy tale loses all value. Looking at the story from the outside, it would seem unnecessary to have the genie's thought undergo such changes from wishing to reward the person who will set him free to deciding to punish him. Now, the story could be told as just an evil genie wishing to kill his liberator, who, although only a weak human, nevertheless manages to outsmart the powerful spirit. But in this simplified form, it becomes just a scary tale with a happy ending, without psychological truth to it. And the genie's change from wishing to reward to wishing to punish, which permits the child to empathize with the story. Since the story so truthfully describes what went on in the genie's mind. The idea that the fisherman may be able to outwit the genie also attains veracity. It is the elimination of such seemingly insignificant elements that make fairy tales lose their deeper meaning, and thus makes them uninteresting to the child. Without being conscious of it, the child rejoices in the fairy tale's warning to those who hold the power to bottle him up. There are plenty of modern children's stories in which a child outwits an adult, but because they are too direct, these stories do not suffer relief in imagination from always having to live under the sway of adult power, or else they scare the child, whose security rests on the adult being more accomplished than he and able to protect him reliably. Kind of weird if the kid is smarter than the parent, you know? You gotta worry about the parent. The kid constantly outsmarts the parent. Where does that go? The parent is always trying to... there's so many different situations with parenthood. But primarily... a kid will always test his parents, and a sibling will always test his brothers and sisters, and who's strongest, who's smartest, who gets away with more. These things are all weighed in a family and never forgotten. So we live in these relationships. We tolerate these relationships in part because we they're fairy tale like, and we always come up with the same ending. We either get angry and reconcile, or we get angry and slay the dragon, or the demon or the monster, or we become smarter than the monster, So they seem to think we know it all. Boy, we were so smart at 6 and 7 years old. I was the smartest kid I ever knew at 6 years old. And I got incredibly dumb after that. But 6 is a year of magic. It's a magical year. One where everything is possible. There are no limitations. Or if there are, you don't want to know about them. That's the magic years. That so formulate our minds. I'll end on. I've got a few more minutes on this next chapter. Fairy tale versus myth. Optimism versus pessimism. Plato, who may have understood better what forms the mind of man than do some of our contemporaries who want their children exposed only to real people and everyday events, knew what intellectual experiences make for true humanity. He suggested that the future citizens of his idyllic republic begin their literary education with the telling of myths rather than with mere facts or so-called rational teachings. Even Aristotle, master of pure reason, said the friend of wisdom is also a friend of myth. The modern thinkers who have studied myths and fairy tales from a philosophical or a psychological viewpoint arrive at the same conclusion, regardless of their original persuasion. Mircea Eliade, for one, describes these stories as models for human behavior that by that very fact give meaning and value to life. In drawing on anthropological parallels, he and others suggest that myths and fairy tales were derived from and give symbolic expression to initiation rites or other rites to passage, such as a metaphoric death of an old inadequate self in order to be reborn on a higher plane of existence. He feels that this is why these tales meet a strongly felt need in the carriers of such deep meaning. Other investigators with a deep psychological orientation emphasize the similarities between the fantastic events in myths and fairy tales and those in adult dreams and daydreams. The fulfillment of wishes, the winning out over all competitors, the destruction of enemies, and then conclude that one attraction of this literature is its expression of that which is normally prevented from coming to awareness. There are, of course, very significant differences between fairy tales and dreams. For example, in dreams, more often than not, the wish fulfillment is disguised, while in fairy tales, much of it is openly expressed. To a considerable degree, dreams are the result of inner pressures which have found no relief, or problems which beset a person to which he knows no solution, and to which the dream finds none. The fairy tale does the opposite. It projects the relief of all pressures, and not only offers ways to solve problems, but promises that a happy solution will be found. And that's really the truth. I mean, that's why fairy tales are so very powerful. So very powerful. And I may further read through this, but I highly suggest that, you know, if you can get a copy of this fascinating book, you know, Psychology and Literature, put out by Vintage, Vintage, you might want to look it up and see if you, I haven't looked to see if it was in Amazon or something and used books, but you might find it. Some, I'm sure there were a lot of copies printed back then. It's got a USBN number and is done out in 89, I believe, is this printing. Yeah, 1989 vintage book editions. But you can also, there was also a previous one which was Random House, 1975, and again in 76. So, you know, you might want to check this book out if you can buy it. Yeah, I think it's great. One of which is Bring Order into Chaos, Tale of Two Brothers, The Goose Cult. What's the Goose Cult? What's that one? The Goose Girl, Achieving Autonomy, okay? All of these fairy tales that happen where people change and their lives change and they outsmart, or spells are cast on them, or all these things. And, you know, these are the marks of genius and the marks of the things that we love as children and remember so well with pleasant memories as adults. Those are fairy tales. So, thank you so much for listening tonight. Hope you enjoyed the show. I want to thank all who supported the show, and we're getting real close to the 50,000 listener number right now. And I want to thank everybody who's listened. It's been great. We're getting about 1,000 listeners a week right now, and I want to thank every one of you for tuning in. Not only to this particular show, but to all of our, and going into our archives and enjoying the last 4 years we've had on this Blog Talk Radio, and also on our WQQQ. So thank you, and I wish you a pleasant evening. Oh, and join us tomorrow when we have George Dixon joining us. We have Friday night with George Dixon, Lila, and myself. And good night.